Okay, Dick. Well, I have both. I have cable, but I have the antenna on the chimney, and those signals do come in perfect, like you said, when the signals are there. As far as transmitting on 2 meters, the beam is about 15 feet away from that. Anytime I transmit, that's it. The whole signal goes away, and you get the message on the screen, you know, that the signal is weak, you know. So, well, without transmitting, pretty good. I mean, I get two, I forget about four. I get most of the regular stations, 2, 5, 9, 11, 13, 21, and all these other bizarre stations that they have now. So probably collectively maybe 20, 25 stations. A lot of them are duplicates. For instance, Channel 2, you have another Channel 2, which gives you weather and all of that. But most important thing to put on, Dick, I think, is the preamp, especially for me. The type that, you know, the coax comes into the house, goes right into my preamp in the house. Actually, I have that in the basement. And then out of the preamp, then I go into the TV, or all my TVs. I have set up for about 3 or 4 TVs. And that thing plugs into the wall, by the way. It's one of those. And well worth it. I mean, without that, I barely get any stations. You got to have the amplifier, Dick. I really recommend that. Back to you.
WA2RYY with a comment.
How about that? I mentioned you earlier as a television DXer. And so, first of all, Paul, that's good news. Somebody as far out as Ronkonkoma is getting over-the-air broadcast television with a preamplifier. But then again, you're also confirming that even though you're using a much more modern television set than I am, still, when you go on 2 meters, you wipe out a lot of the material. Let's see what Joe's got to say about all of the above. I'm amazed you're staying up this late, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
So am I. Yeah, I have my ears on. I'm on the desktop doing some computer stuff just for a couple minutes here. Putting a preamp on is a very helpful thing to do, but one thing you have to be very careful about is knowing your RF environment. You may just hook it up to your antenna, and think there's just nothing else out there that's going to bother you. Wrong. There's a lot of RF energy that's starting to pop up in the 730, 740 megahertz band, 722, 730, 5 megahertz band, which is the new band for LTE stuff. For both carriers, for Verizon and AT&T. So you may have something like that pop up very close to you, as well as regular standard cell sites from 880 to 890. All this kind of stuff coming down into your preamp will cause it to overload and cause your converter not to work properly. You must investigate and get yourself a filter and reject all this stuff from being amplified by your preamp. Very, very important.
Okay, I'm hearing some good news here. So with the right kind of filtering and the right kind of a preamp, Joe on the South Shore in Sable, I think it is getting some darn good reception. Here we are with Paul way out there in Ronkonkoma, getting some darn good reception. You're very vulnerable to 2 meter transmitter, but I know, similar to all other kinds of ham radio caused television interference, with the right kind of shielding and the right kind of filtering, almost every single television interference situation is solvable. So the fact that it doesn't work at first doesn't mean you're dead in the water. It means you're going to have to do some work in order to make it work. That's what I'm hearing, John. So we got a little bit of bad news and some good news as I see it. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
It's 375 backup, Dick.
Yes, it is. 375 is backup, so we don't have to do another drop. You got it, John.
Very good, Dick. I want to leave them out. KC2WGB. Okay. Okay. The next question he had, they are using a Yagi. They have very good reception. I believe he's in Queens. Now, he has, the width of the house is 45 feet. So if he puts it on, if he puts the 2-meter antenna on the other side of the house, it'll be 45 feet away, and it will be facing the back of the antenna, the reflectors. So do you think he should just negate putting it on the TV mast and try at first the other side of the house, maybe in a tripod or something? You think that would be the best bet?
I think the answer is yes. When it comes to television interference, there are three things that you can do. Number one, very good shielding. Number two, very good filtering. Number three, do whatever you can to make the signal weaker, the offending signal. Distance is an extremely good way, inverse square law. Every time you double the distance between your transmitting antenna and the television aerial, you'll get 1/4 of the amount of power of the ham radio signal into the television aerial. So if you've got 40 foot more separation, that means that the amount of filtering required, the amount of shielding required, will decrease. The amount of grief will decrease. So if you want to use all of the advantages you've got, distance, shielding, filtering, can you make the 2-meter transmitter and the television signal compatible? Absolutely. What we're really discussing here is how much work is going to be required for your particular environment. The good news about Queens, most of Queens has got some darn good, strong television reception because it's so darn close to New York City. Queens is one of the 5 boroughs of New York City. So you're in the prime area of strong signals. You're not going to have anywhere near as much grief as I have. So I know he's going to be able to make it work, John. What we're not super clear on is how hard he's going to have to work to make it work. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Very good, Dick. Yeah, I agree. I think the distance would probably be his best bet. Also, he's running in all mode. 30 watts is his maximum power. So I don't think at 45 feet, may have a little interference with one or two channels, but I don't think it'll wipe it out. I think that's his best bet also. Okay, let's go over to Paul. That's it from the mailbag, and thank you very much. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, you're getting some darn good questions these days, John. Hey, you guys out there, keep those cards and letters coming to John. Paul, what's NASA doing? And I know there's a lot to doing. And we've got the New Horizons, the one that's about to gonna go by Pluto and take some beautiful close-up pictures for the first time in the history of mankind. I know that's almost a little less than a year away. I think it's next July that takes place. But I guarantee there's a whole bunch of other things taking place. From time to time, I'm hearing about some super large diameter parabolic dish antennas that are going into optical telescopes as well as radio telescopes. And the millimeter wave radio telescope of the European Southern Observatory in Chile is starting to do some real good work. So John and I are worrying about, are we going to live? Are we going to live long enough to see some of these beautiful things take place? Let's hope that your signal is going to be strong enough to get over this signal. If you're hearing things that you think shouldn't be there, go to the reverse mode on your rig and let down the signal strength and report it at livebox.org. RFI@livebox.org. Whatever you hear that you think shouldn't be there, give it a try here, John. I mean, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW in the check line.
Okay. No, this is WS2N. I'll try a different way. Give me a second.
Don't change the way. Don't change it. You're coming through. You're coming through beautifully.
Double.
say I spoke too soon, Paul. You were coming through beautifully at first. And I think you said you've got an alternate technique.
Okay, we'll try this. SpaceX launched this morning at 1 o'clock Asia 6 satellite to a geosynchronous orbit, and it went well. They had to delay because of the Falcon 9 reusable that blew up in Texas about a couple of weeks ago. So apparently didn't stop this one because it doesn't have those returnable legs and system that they've had on previous launches. Because they wanted to put this into a geosynchronous orbit, they needed all the power they could get to do that. Okay, how am I doing, Dick?
You're doing very well. Please continue.
Okay, the Clio satellite is supposed to go up on the 16th. The Clio satellite is a top secret government launch. In fact, there's no government agency that even claims this thing. I mean, nobody. DARPA. But it's going up on an Atlas, a big rocket, and that'll be launched also probably within a week or so. But it's unbelievable what's going on. These things, I'm sure it's all military, but the Clio satellite, you can't find any information about it. Very little information about it on the internet. Let me drop.
If it's no secret, Paul, how did you find out about it?
I said, very little information. If you go to some of the websites, they'll tell you the next launches of something, so they'll say the Clio satellite, or whatever, and then you try to research it. I have basically what it looks like. I have pictures of it. It stands about maybe 15 feet high. It's got big antennas. It kind of looks like I'll copy the WS2N. Okay. Let me see if I'm doing okay here. Stand by. Okay. This mission I really wanted to discuss is the SMAP mission, SMAP. There are many satellites that go up that, I don't mention every one. If I would, there's probably 500 to 600 satellites globally that are launched, and I don't cover them all. And a lot of them are satellites that are looking down at the Earth and measuring the air quality and this and that. There's quite a few of those, but this one here, the SMAP mission, is called the Soil Moisture Active Passive Mission. is something different. This is almost a $490 million project, but call it a half a billion dollars. They're going to delay it a little bit. It's supposed to go up in October, then November. It looks like it's going to go up in December of this year. And it'll be launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base, and it'll be put into a polar orbit. Can we drop it? Interesting thing about this is that what they want to do is they want to look at the soil, and they want to look at the soil globally, and they want to find out if it's either frozen, or is it just wet, or is it dry. And to do this, they're going to use a radar. So, okay, you think of a radar, put it up in space, how big does the antenna have to be, how much power does it have to use? Well, they're going to be transmitting 500 watts, and they're going to be transmitting to an offset parabolic beam antenna. But the size of this antenna is going to be 6.8 meters, like 20 feet in diameter. And when you transmit something using that, I think it's 1.4, something like that, 1.4 gig, down to Earth with the beam width and all this, and I think 35 dB or something, you're only going to get a circle on the Earth about 40 kilometers wide. Let's call it 25 miles. Let me drop it. What they need to do is they need to cover a path or a swat, and they'd like to do 1,000 kilometers, you know, looking at 600 miles in one pass. And this way they could cover the whole Earth in 2 or 3 days. Now, to do this whole thing, this 20 feet diameter antenna, it's going to be a mesh. It'll be all folded up inside a Delta II rocket. It's going to blast off from, like I said, Vandenberg with 3 boosters attached to it. They're going to blast at the 400 mile high altitude. A sun synchronous orbit this way. It brings it over the same location on a regular basis. So they'll be able to see the difference from time to time. But to do this whole thing, this 20-foot thing, is going to be spinning above the spacecraft. I mean, you know, you got to see this thing. It's got an arm coming out of the center of the spacecraft. The spacecraft itself doesn't spin. But what spins is the radar and the radiometer. The two things. So one's active, the other one's passive, and that'll be pointing offset towards this parabolic dish. Let me drop it. Parabolic dish is a like a gold mesh. It's a very tight mesh. I think they said 20 openings per inch is the size that they're looking at. So it's a very tight mesh, but very lightweight. I don't think this thing weighs 80 pounds or something. But when it opens up, this whole setup is going to spin above the spacecraft. I mean, it reminds me of, you know, these round-up things when you went on, you know, as a kid, you if you are a kid today, you go to, you know, Adventures Inn and you get onto one of these round-up things. Well, that's about 30 feet in diameter or so. Well, this thing's about 20. And those things, I looked it up, those things spin at around 16 RPM. This thing got this 1,000 wide swat. Point something, I think 14 and a half. Call it 14 revolutions per minute. And to spin it, you know, this arm comes up, and it's not attached to the center of the spinning thing. It's offset. I mean, it's attached to the side of this 20-foot disc, and it's spinning along, and it's got all kinds of
like I'm able to come through. Beautiful pole. I did a quick calculation. I got a program that, because when it comes to a stress parabolic dish, that's one of my favorite subjects. Obvious by, you can see a picture of me holding one of those things on the front cover of QST magazine, August 1972, way back in the dark ages. Mine was a 12-foot dish, so this 6.8 meters, roughly 20-foot diameter dish, and you did say 1.4 gigahertz, that calculates to be 36.8 decibels of gain, 2.46 degrees of beam width. If the satellite was 200 miles up, you would be looking at a diameter of Earth. You're looking down the Earth. It's like a flashlight beam, and the flashlight beam is going to be 8 miles in diameter. So you're looking at 8-mile diameter of Earth at every instant of time as you flash this dish. And let me drop. So when it comes to measuring soil moisture and things like that as you're flying over various portions of planet Earth, that sounds like a fun thing to do. Now, a 20-foot diameter dish rotating. Wow. Very similar to what I do with Yagis. You want to make sure your Yagi is not only gravity balanced, but wind balanced. So that the wind blowing from the side doesn't try to make the antenna aim downwind. By the same token, what you want to do with a thing that you're rotating like this.
For the radar, it's one correction, 1.2 gig. I said it was the 1.4, the radiometer was 1.41 gig. It's got a resolution 1, 2, 3 kilo per meter, and then they have next to it a 40 kilometer for the radiometer. And they got the position 6 meters, what else is this? 14.6 RPM, yeah. I read that before. The swath is 1,000 kilometers. Polar sun synchronous. Yeah, that's about it. And the altitude is 640 kilometers. But there are some other technical pieces of information, but I think that's good enough. Back to you, Dick.
Info, Dick. What was that again, John?
I just want to let the people know we had about 10 on Echolink, and Echolink went down and dropped everybody. It's up now, so people can sign back in if they wish. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Any idea what made Echolink go down? Is that because of a timeout or some other thing like that, or is it just that the internet every so often does a hiccup? What do you think it is, John?
The operator made that happen.
Oh, okay. Are you telling me that there was a little bit of pilot error there, Eric?
Well, I was looking for a source, so I just wanted to eliminate all variables.
Well done. Understand. Very glad you're in the command center at tonight, Bull. So, 600 kilometers, 640 kilometers up. I made a guess of 200 miles. I was low. Therefore, the real spot on the ground is even bigger. So, I think this is going to be using, I'm trying to remember the name of the parameters. The name of a mathematical set of numbers that you do with a radiometer. When you take polarimetry data, radiometry data, swept frequency data, you can find out how much moisture there is at various altitudes in the atmosphere. In this case, you're measuring moisture of soil and I guess snow cover and things like that. So this SNAP satellite, SMAP, S-M-A-P, I think it is, mission, is going to be measuring moisture at 1.4 gigs. I don't think you have ground penetrating radar capability. It sure would be nice to be able to know how deep down is the moisture. So is this primarily a agricultural set of measurements that are going to take place? Is that the main motivation, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW?
Yeah, I know you missed that in the beginning. I'll repeat the, 5 centimeters down, that's what, like 2 inches into the ground. And they want to know if it's frozen or if it's wet. So this has that capability at 500 watts. I don't know if you got that before. And, I mean, the whole solar panels, the craft is being supplied 1,500 watts, so about 500 is dedicated to the transmitter. And my question to you, Dick, was the radiometer, is that like, when they say that's the passive part, that's the receiving, and then the radar is the transmitting? In other words, is that what they mean when they say that? I wonder if you understand what I'm reading here, Dick. This whole thing is, like I said, $500 million. You might have missed that in the beginning as well. Back to you, Dick.
And a question, Dick.
Okay, let's go over to the question first. Go ahead, John.
Dick, I know you've worked much with radar. What do you think they do with the ocean? Do you think they use that as the control and compare the soil moisture content with the emissions they're getting from, or the reflections they're getting from the oceans? Do you think that's how they're doing it?
I think I see where you're going, John, and I agree with you that the ocean would give you a calibration, the amount of echo you get from particular sea states. is something that's very well documented in a whole series of radar books by Barton, B-A-R-T-O-N. And it's probably even documented in the, let me think now. Why can't I think of the name of the radar handbook that everybody, I can't think of the name of the guy who publishes the radar handbook, the author. It'll come to me in a few minutes. But the right section there. As we discussed earlier on the TechNet years ago, you put an ice cube or a snowball in your microwave oven alongside of a glass of water. You'll be amazed that the glass of water will boil. The snowball, nothing will happen. The ice cube, nothing will happen. Ice is a very different crystalline material compared to liquid water. So therefore, the way you get reflectivity of the radar signal from ice below the surface versus water below the surface is very characteristic. There's a significant amount of contrast there, in my opinion. Now, a radar receiver is usually something in the vicinity of a few megacycles wide, and is looking for very specific pulses of echo. You're transmitting pulses, and you're looking for a very specific shape of the pulse of the echo coming back, and you're primarily measuring the amplitude. That's if it's not a swept frequency radar. And if it is swept in frequency, there's a couple of advantages and a couple of things you can get out of that. A radiometer, let me drop. I've almost never heard of a radar receiver being used as a radiometer. I am guessing that this satellite simultaneously has a radar receiver and a radiometer receiver. The exact same antenna and the exact same low noise amplifier as the front end can serve for both. But then I'm guessing the signal splits, and in one direction it's going to a radiometer, in another direction it's going to a radar specific receiver. Radiometry is a really crazy kind of, let's call it radio telescope. Ordinarily a radio telescope is something you aim out into the dark sky and look for individual stars. Let me drop. But there's nothing stopping you from aiming a radiometer down at the ground and getting useful information out of it. One of the radiometry-like measurements I made was to stand in front of the dish on a wooden chair adjusting the feed on, and there was a radiometry receiver connected to that dish, my 12-foot dish, running at 2.8 gigahertz, and I was amazed how the heat coming off my body creates a broadband noisy signal at 2.4 gigahertz, 2.2 gigahertz, and the amount of 2.2 gigahertz radiated in a broadband noisy manner by my body, because I'm at 98 degrees Fahrenheit, pegged the receiver. The noisy signal coming off my body at 2.2 gigs pegged the receiver. And I suddenly realized that I could take that dish, aim it through a sheetrock wall, and tell you immediately whether or not there was a human being or a dog, anything that's warm in that room, I would see it by the radiometry signal. Radiometry, let me drop. Radiometry usually has an extremely broadband RF front end and IF. There are radiometers that are 4 megs wide, 40 megs wide, 400 megs wide, 4 gigahertz wide. The wider the radiometer bandwidth of its receiver, the more sensitive. It's capable with a Dickey switch calibrator, where 400 times per second it's switching back and forth between the real antenna and a known dummy load and a known temperature. You can measure easily with a good radiometer 1 degree Kelvin of temperature. It's very, very, very sensitive. And so radiometers can find very, very weak signals. In other words, you could have a weak star passing through your radio telescope acting as a radiometer. The star may have an amount of energy that's 1/1000th of the noise power from your own receiver front end because of its noise figure. Your electronics is making noise 1,000 times louder, 30 dB louder than the star you're looking at. And a good radiometer will relatively easily detect the presence of that star as it sweeps through that antenna pattern. The magic of radiometry is you can measure signals that are pretty far below the noise. A little bit similar to WSJT, weak signal JT, Joe Taylor, K1JT's fancy modulation techniques can also measure signals, in his case, 28 dB weaker than the noise of your receiver. But it's a very specifically formatted receiver, a very formatted set of pulses on various tones of the signal that you're transmitting. In order to do that, let me drop. What I'm guessing here, Bull, is that this SNAP receiver, really has two separate receivers, the radar receiver and a radiometry receiver. Radiometry ordinarily doesn't switch. Let me take that back. The Dickey switch rate and the radar pulse rate, could they be made the same? I guess they could. I'm not super sure as to what's going on here, Paul. We're going to have to read a little bit more about this. You've triggered my curiosity. I'm going to see what I can find on the internet on this fancy satellite. I think you said it's $500 million. Has it been launched? When is it? You did say it's predicted originally October, but you think more likely December is when this thing's going to be launched. And by Vandenberg Air Force Base, it's going to be going into a north-south orbit, a polar orbit. So as it sweeps from North Pole to South Pole back to North Pole, and as the Earth slowly rotates underneath, this thing will eventually be able to look at every square mile, every square kilometer of planet Earth, as I see it. And back to you, Paul, WS2N, K2RIW.
Standby one.
Quick question in the meantime, Dick.
Okay, in fact, Dick, I just wanted to go over it's one little paragraph. I think this is going to give you more information of what we're talking about here. The SMAP mission concept includes an L-band radiometer and an L-band high-resolution radar that share a single feed horn and parabolic mesh reflector. We kind of went over that before, but the radar operates with, now this is what I don't understand, VV, HH, and HV/VH transmit, receive polarizations, and use separate transmit frequencies for the H. They have 1.26 gigs, and the V is 1.29 gig polarization. And then there's a little bit more information after that. Maybe what I could do is eventually email you this, Dick, back to you. 3D?
Yeah, I've got a guess as to what's going on here. V and H stands for vertical and horizontal polarization. VV means you transmit vertical, receive vertical. HH means you transmit horizontal, receive horizontal. VH means you transmit vertical, receive horizontal. At first you think that's crazy. Well, it turns out that every radar target has a certain degree of cross-polarization creation, call it Condon lobes, call it chirality. In other words, you could transmit a signal vertically polarized down at the Earth. You're going to get a certain amplitude of co-polarized signal. You're going to get a certain amplitude of cross-polarized signal in the echo. That's valuable information. The ratio of the cross-polarized to the non-cross-polarized is valuable information. Can't think of the name of this mathematical function where you make enough measurements on enough frequencies and enough polarizations, you can get an awful lot of signatures of the environment to find out how much ice, how much water, how many centimeters down, and so on. You get a kind of an almost, let me drop it. You get what I could naively call an X-ray picture from surface to 5 centimeters down as to what's there. And I think they've done things like that with Mars to detect the fact that they're seeing lots of evidence of a whole lot of ice below the surface of Mars. I think there's been a prediction made that if you melted all the ice on Mars, you'd have quite a few feet of water across the whole darn planet. So that's my guess as to what's going on there, Paul. Drag your feet because I think somebody else is asking us something. WS2N to take it with some delay. K2LIW in the TechNet.
By 2A, do you think they're looking for tunnels?
I kind of doubt that, Lou. They've already said that this L-band system can look down 5 centimeters. If you and I were building a tunnel and we wanted to pass hardware, human beings, or whatever through it, guarantee we would not make the tunnel only 5 centimeters deep. NY2H, K2LAW.
Maybe looking for ants. All right, NY2H.
That's a darn good guess, Lou, but I doubt it. In order to make a ground-penetrating radar, you'd really like to have the antenna right on the surface of the Earth. To do ground-penetrating radar with any reasonable angular resolution from 600 kilometers in space, I won't say it's impossible, but wow, I think that would be extremely difficult. So I think this is really agricultural research and meteorological research. I don't think that this is a classified mission. I think this is very different than that Clio satellite we were talking about earlier. WS2N, K2LAW, you got a poll.
Oh, yeah, you're right. This is one of these, you know, global climate change type of things. There's half a dozen of these satellites up there now. Not this one. I mean, this is something new. But these types of things, it shows that it'll be looking for moisture in the soil, and then whether or not it's dry, you know, like a dry soil, and all 5 centimeters down. And then the reflectivity, like you said, with the snowball in the microwave, they get nothing back, so they know that that'll be frozen. So that's the way they're going to use this thing. And and that's why it's sun synchronized. They want to come over the same spot every 2 or 3 days, and then they're going to judge globally from, you know, every 2 days that, you know, what the changes are. They want to know where the moisture is, what portion of it's frozen, what portion of it's not. Right now, they want exact numbers. Right now, they have all computer models, and this is going to give them a real exact number. But yeah, that's the goal of this thing. It's nothing to do with agriculture. They'll be able to use it. Weather forecasting, they'll be able to use it. It'll be open source once it gets online. Like anybody, anywhere, any country can use it.
History is repeating itself a little bit here, Paul. The Skylab mission of roughly 1972-73 had an L-band radiometer. It was a phased array antenna operating at roughly 1.4 gigahertz. My goodness, the correlation here is amazing. So Skylab had a 1.4 gigahertz phased array antenna aimed at the Earth as it flew over the Earth. And that particular L-band radiometer was built by some little company on Long Island called Airborne Instruments Laboratory. I didn't work on that project, but I remember talking to the people who did, and they really enjoyed that work. So we've been doing L-band radiometry measurements for meteorological reasons as the Skylab passed over various portions of the Earth, and Skylab didn't cover anywhere near as much area of its Earth as this polar satellite is going to be measuring. And by being sun synchronous, in other words, by choosing the right altitude, let me drop. You choose the right altitude and inclination of orbit, That determines how often you you whiz around the Earth. The Earth is turning underneath at a very known rate, and therefore, I think you said every 3 days, this snap is going to be able to see the exact same chunk of Earth 3 days later, repetitively, and therefore, as the seasons change, you'll be able to look at, let me pick a number, the permafrost in Alaska. How fast is it melting in the springtime? And is the permafrost in Alaska slowly changing by way of global warming? And there's some evidence of that. But to do it from space, where you can look at a zillion square miles when you properly process all the data, is very valuable information as I see it for what I think they're doing with this. And once again, how many watts did you say this is transmitting? I vaguely remember you said 500 watts. WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, it is a 500 watt transmitter, and the whole solar panels produce 1400 watts, I think I read. And coming from the mechanical world, actually, I was more fascinated with how is this thing going to spin. You know, it's got a motor in there and all. And when they first were thinking about it, they were saying, well, let's spin the whole satellite. And then they said, no, we want to be able to keep the other part of the satellite stable. We want to work the teacher satellites. We want ground communications. But because of that thing hanging over their heads, they can't get the GPS. So what they're doing is they're using frequencies, sending frequencies to it and from it, and going to measure the frequencies, and then that's how they're going to figure out where this thing is in space. No GPS. So I want to see this thing. I mean, it's, when you think about 14 RPM, that's roughly the same speed as these spinning rides, and you look at these kids going around, and that thing is moving, and and they're going to have this thing in space, and that thing's in it's moving. It's bolted to the center of the thing. This is bolted to the end of it. And you'll see it when you see the drawing. SMAP, soil map, active, passive system. Back to you, Dick.
Question, Dick. Going to pass it over to John in a minute. 36.8 dB of gain is my calculation, based on 60% aperture efficiency and a 20-foot diameter dish. 36.8 dB, when you convert that into numbers, is 4,700 and something. So that's the gain of the dish, 4,700. You put 500 watts into that, you multiply those two together, their effective radiated power is 2.39, almost 2.4 million watts. 2.4 million watts is the peak envelope power of that beam when it's aimed at you, the effective radiated power of that dish. That's a pretty nice radar. KC2 WGB, K2LAW. More power to you, John.
The cell phone people are going to be upset with this thing all day.
Not at all. Not at all. Get to that in a minute. John, go ahead.
K2 WGB. Yeah, we're all going to die. I have a question. Do you think it might have agrarian use, such as crop moisture levels in crops, trees, also fire risk analysis, things like that? What do you think of the chances of that, Dick?
I think you're right on, John. When you get this kind of data, you're going to get people into forestry, people into farming, people into all kinds of things. They're going to say, hey, I can use that data. That did take place on Skylab, the L-band radiometer of Skylab. In its primitive days compared to modern-day systems, gave them data that they can definitely use. So knowing that certain areas of, let's say, California are super dry by way of the satellite measurements is going to tell you the chances of getting a range fire, and you better start preparing for it, because if one little spark comes along and you get these super dry conditions, you're going to get a lot of square miles of burning forest all at once. Yeah, mankind is is disturbing things that Mother Nature used to do. By way of lightning, Mother Nature used to create forest fires periodically. And we make sure that every fire gets put out real fast, so we never get a chance to burn away all the leaf matter and everything else at the bottom of the trees. We never get a chance to burn away the actual trees. A number of those tree species are perfectly healthy to literally be burned down every few years. And we've been interrupting that cycle. And all of a sudden, because we're storing up all this energy, because we don't let the fire take place, when it finally does happen, it becomes a fairly uncontrollable event. So there's lots of people arguing back and forth, should we put out all of these range fires, or should we just let them burn? That's what Mother Nature used to do. And now, 2.4 million watts of peak envelope power. Depending on the duty cycle of the radar, in other words, the radar transmits a brief pulse, X number of microseconds long, and then some number of milliseconds later, you transmit another pulse. You're really only on the air 1% of the time, 0.1% of the time, and so on. When it comes to heating of biological material, in other words, radio frequency biohazard, is not a function of peak power, peak envelope power. It's average power. You take, for instance, this radar that I used to work with, this man-pack radar called the PIPS-5, PPS-5 radar. It put out million-watt pulses, but the pulses were so brief that the average power output was 1 watt. And this thing, although it transmits a 500-watt peak pulse power, I don't know the exact number, but for all we know, the average power transmitted is 5 watts. Yes, it's going through 36.8 dB of antenna gain, but when you're 600 kilometers away, by the inverse square law, the actual amount of power that's going to hit your human body standing right under this radar as it flies overhead, it's going to take laboratory instrumentation for you to even measure it. Is it going to create a
repeater? Timeout.
Is it going to create a biohazard? Glad to see that 375 is still on. Is it going to create a biohazard? Is it going to interrupt your cell phone? Not a chance. It might give you a little bit of interference if it was on the exact same frequency and you were in a very weak cell coverage area. So, as I see it, these things are very compatible. It's somewhat similar to what goes on with the many other kinds of spread spectrum transmissions. There's a whole lot of transmitters in the 2.4 gigahertz, 802.11 as it's called, frequency region, license-free region, where even though you've got multiple emitters seemingly on the exact same frequency, because the spread spectrum characteristic has a different signature for those different signals, they essentially don't see each other. They're orthogonal to each other is the fancy word they use for it. So is this going to create problems with humans? Is it going to create problems with cell phones? I'm reasonably sure the answer is no, and all of that. WS2N, fascinating satellite. K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Okay, very good, Dick. That's pretty much all I had. We'll see how things go for next week. But every time I turn around, there's more and more different types of satellites going up. We don't have as many manned missions as we used to. But that won't be changing. Probably changing around 2017 or so. Maybe, hopefully, the end of 2016. And you were right about New Horizon. We'll look forward to that at the end of next year, 2015, roughly July. And we'll look forward to the MAVEN going into orbit around Mars in November, and along with actually probably October. Let me get my months right. No, September. That would be September because it's only about 1 week different than the Indian satellite. We'll be going around orbit at Mars in September. Should be coming up. I'll have to look that one up. And, of course, we got the Orion test vehicle going up. EFT-1 exploration flight test number one. And that'll be launched on the Delta Heavy from Florida. That will be televised. That will be, the news will have that. And we'll see how that one goes. And of course, the landing of Philippe with the, from the Rosetta spacecraft going to Comet 67P. That landing will be in November as well. Back to you, Dick. That's pretty much all for now. Any questions? It would be spacenetreport@gmail.com. Back to you, Dick.
I'm not sure now. John, did I think you had a question, and I may have not given you a chance. Go ahead, John.
No, Paul answered the question in the last statement he made about the feed order being common for both. I was going to broach the subject that it might be two separate instruments, and he confirmed that.
If you do a good job of designing the feed horn for a parabolic dish, the feed horn itself can be very broadband. In some cases, you've got a low-frequency horn that's large in diameter, and in the center of that horn, you've got a higher-frequency horn, a second one. And the parabolic dish surface itself is extremely broadband. You can feed it 40 frequencies simultaneously if you can design enough transmitters that couple into your feed horn. So a parabolic dish antenna could be operating on a whole bunch of different frequencies, a whole bunch of different frequency regions, all simultaneously. And you've got the right kind of filtering in the frequency domain and the time domain. Let me drop. All those individual functions will not interfere with each other. There have been a small number of guys who set up a parabolic dish as a ham radio operator, and they run in-band, cross-band, or mostly cross-band. In other words, I could be transmitting on 432 into the dish, receiving on 1296 simultaneously, and the guy you're talking to doing the opposite. And now you've got full duplex telephone-like conversation. Everything you say is being heard by the guy that you're talking to. Everything he says, you're hearing, and you're doing this all simultaneously. I've done those kind of QSOs. We even did between me, Alan Katz, K2UIH, and Judd Snyder, K2CBA, we did a three-band simultaneously. Let me drop. I was transmitting on 432 up to Judd, K2CBA. I was transmitting at 432 to Alan over there in New Jersey, KQIH. He was transmitting on 1296 up to Judd in Albany, K2CBA, and Judd was transmitting back down to me on 2 meters.